Top 100
Project.
And action.
Howdy do, partners, and hop on board the Top 100 Project, the podcast that takes a gander at the AFI's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Very big warning, this podcast has a mountain of spoilers. I'm Ryan Ellis, and seated to my right is my wife, Beth.
That's me.
So the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, Shane. After the 84-point increase for The Searchers, which Western rose the most between the 1998 Top 100 and the 2007 Top 100? The Wild Bunch, Unforgiven, or Shane?
I'm taking a guess. Unforgiven.
That is correct.
Yes.
It climbed 30 spots. Shane climbed up 24, and The Wild Bunch only moved up one spot.
Well, it's typical for newer films to be held in higher esteem a decade later.
I'm a little bit surprised Unforgiven is that much more respected. It was 92 or something the first time, and then it went all the way up into the 60s. And that's a huge rise for any film, especially something that was 15 years old when the second list came out.
Mm-hmm. I've got to see it again. It's been so long.
All right, anyway, so let's get to the main event here. The Top 100 Project's 45th movie, Shane, was 69th on AFI's 1998 list between An American to Paris and The French Connection, but zoomed all the way up those 24 spots to 45th in 2007 between rom-coms The Philadelphia Story and It Happened One Night. After a premiere on April 23, 1953, Shane was released by Paramount on June 4th. The big-budget film was a huge success and made so much money. Bev's going to tell us all about it with her skinny.
An Old West gunfighting drifter named Shane takes up with Wyoming homesteaders Joe Starrett and his wife Marion, along with their young son Joey. Local conflicts draw a reluctant Shane into the middle of danger and violence, all while he deals with a mutual attraction to Marion and Joey's hero worship. Shane was played by Alan Ladd, Joe Starrett by Van Heflin, Marion was played by Jean Arthur, and little Joey's played by Brandon DeWilde.
Another big name that we didn't mention yet, we'll get to him, of course, as we go through, but Jack Wilson is played by Jack Palance.
Mm-hmm.
One of the more memorable performances in the film, and one of the shorter ones.
Yeah, he's incredibly sinister. Really good.
But in a nutshell, man pistol whips friend into unconsciousness, then commits murder on friend's behalf.
Accurate.
The messiah-like Shane taking the bullet for his friends.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of Shane?
I loved it. I said in last week's podcast that this movie's been recommended to me by more people than I can count, and I see why. It doesn't feel its age, even though it's definitely a film of its age. There's something modern and, well, more timeless about it. It has incredible depth. It was very adeptly directed and acted and written. Really a great film. I loved it.
The plane flying overhead right now agrees. That's not period, guys. Come on. Yeah, the movie's 61 years old in a couple of months.
Yeah,
it doesn't. And you're right, I don't know that it really has aged that much. High Noon, which we certainly raved about last week, in some ways has more. And other films of this era and the films that came before, even films that are going to come after, they have aged worse than Shane.
I said also last week because I loved High Noon, and I don't know what it is. I never expected to like the Westerns as much as I have.
But we're three for three.
And I'm trying to kind of figure out why. I think part of it is I just love these silent heroes, like these strong, quiet heroes with a great depth and lots of backstory that we just don't necessarily know about. I love that mystery and I love that subtlety, which is something that movies of the 50s, they weren't necessarily subtle. Place in the Sun, the last George Stevens film that we covered in the project, it's anything but subtle. Everything's right out there on the table, and yet with Shane has so much beautiful mystery behind his motivations and his actions. I think that's what I like about them.
We never find out why Shane is there. We never find out why he's this drifter.
We never find out where he was on his way to.
Mm-hmm. And why he's reluctant to fight when he's challenged, which is the smart thing to do. I mean, why get into a fight over somebody insulting your clothes and your choice of drink, which isn't for you in the first place, it's for the kid.
Mm-hmm.
And he's showing a Jesus-like quality there, turning the other cheek.
Yeah.
Only fights at the end when he really has to.
Well, that's not true, because he does get in a fight before he has to. He goes back and incites a fight.
But
with
a gunfight.
No, not
nobody dies
fight.
In the two fist fights. The one where he and Joe are working together, and the one where he and Joe are, of course, not working together, where they're fighting each other, which is the pistol whipping scene. But yeah, he doesn't pull his gun on anybody until it really matters at the end. He only shoots two different times in the whole film. The very famous scene where he shows Joey how to shoot, which apparently took over 100 takes.
Yeah, he was a terrible shot, as it happens.
He also had that problem. A lot of tough guy type actors had this problem. He blinked when he would shoot. And that doesn't look cool on film. Although it's funny, when they pull wide to show him rapid fire shooting that rock, it's from a distance. There's a few cuts in that scene anyway, but when that moment happens, mm-hmm. it's a long shot. You can't see his eyes anyway.
No, presumably the rock getting hit by a bullet could have just been a little special effects mechanism anyway.
They may have had to just settle for that rather than anything else because they couldn't get him to stop blinking. Yeah. Just like the very famous story about Jack Palance is that he was not good on horses yet. We know he will be in some point in his career with City Slickers.
Yeah.
The two City Slickers movies he made, actually. But at this point, he was new to it. He was a New York actor. As cool and tough as he looked, he was kind of a city boy.
So I think you pointed this out when we were watching the movie, when he's very slowly getting on the horse after a kind of sinister conversation with the homesteaders.
Well, he doesn't have any lines of dialogue, actually.
No, that's right. He's just kind of there.
The Rikers are doing all the talking with Joe. Yeah,
he's just the muscle, right?
Yep. Shane and Jack Wilson aren't saying anything. They're both sizing each other up.
Yeah, that's right. And he just exudes menace. Like, it comes from his pores. He really pulls that off so well. And as he's getting on the horse, he does it really slowly and deliberately. But when I saw that, I thought it was so cool. It actually was an intimidating looking move as he's getting on the horse, and you were the one that told me, oh no, he had to do it that way. Actually, I also read that they shot that scene in reverse. That's actually him getting off the horse, and then they turned it around.
It's the exact same shot, just backwards.
Yeah, so it looks kind of weird, but it just adds to how sinister and awful his character
is. Palance's inability to do his job properly made those scenes better.
It really did.
And
it
by the way, we've both read that we first see Wilson walking his horse into town, which would have been a cool way for a movie to start. There's no way this guy walked his horse for many, many miles.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not true. It just simply isn't true. I watched it very closely when we saw the film together. I watched most of the commentary, specifically went back to that scene to see, is there any second where I'm not seeing that? No. He rides the horse in. They're
just
wrong.
So strange. I read over and over about him walking the horse. What a strange piece of misinformation.
Mm-hmm. We've talked so much about how it's a Western. This is only the third Western out of 45 we've done in all these movies, and yet it's the second in a row. And we have one again, maybe the most famous and certainly the most AFI beloved in a few months, I guess, The Searchers.
What year did The Searchers come
1956.
out? 1956. Okay, so not that long after these two.
No. And then Giant is arguably a Western, also directed by George Stevens. Mm-hmm. So we've got quite a few films in the 50s that are in this genre. And there's so many movies that were made in the 50s that are well-known Westerns. Jimmy Stewart started making a lot of them, including Winchester 73 and Broken Arrow and some other ones. And John Wayne, of course, kept on making Westerns, including, at the end of the decade, Rio Bravo, which wasn't on the list. I don't think it was even nominated. But it's a genre that doesn't really live anymore, unfortunately. There's still Westerns being made here and there. I guess that's the one thing about a movie like Sheen. We're going to talk about some major influences at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But the influence of it being a Western, that didn't take as the decades wore on. And by the 80s, it was a special thing to see a Western. Like, Silverado was unusual. Oh, here's this fun Western that Lawrence Kasdan has made.
Maybe it was just the same conflict over and over again, you know, and a lot of the reviews that I read for Shane, they talked about how it managed to put a fresh spin on a cliche conflict. All these Westerns had the same conflict. The lawless Old West versus the kind of settlers trying to...
Civilization coming into play.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that conflict just there's only so many ways you can do it. And then they ran out of juice.
They even say, though, in the movie, that the nearest marshal is 300 miles away or something? A 3 days ride?
3 days ride. I think it was 100 miles, 3 days ride.
There's no way this guy could ever do anything about any of these problems. These people really, truly are on their own.
Yeah, they have this code where they can only kill somebody if they draw their gun, but that's all they need to do to get permission to kill somebody, and that comes up over and over again.
Well, Jack Wilson does it to Stonewall Torrey.
He incites people to...
A guy who's overmatched, that and that's Elisha Cook Jr. playing that character.
Let's talk about this scene, because I think it's a good kind of example of why this film stands out.
Mm-hmm.
First, the way that they humiliate Elisha Cook, even though he's a good guy and you're on his side, and he's a bit of a hothead, but he's the type of guy that everyone should just let him be a hothead. But the conflict starts with him slipping around on the mud in the ruts, and it's so hard to watch, and it's humiliating while Wilson stands up on the deck and watches him with that sinister look in his eye. And when he shoots him dead, and I don't know if it was the luck, the cloud overhead casts a shadow on him. Well, you didn't notice that. There's this, like, as he's walking towards Wilson, the light changes the way it does, you know, when clouds are moving fast overhead and the sunlight is blocked over him. And they have their argument, and Wilson is raised up high, and he shoots him dead. And what everybody knows is just a cold-blooded murder, really. He, you know, manages to find an excuse by egging him into drawing his gun.
But in the Old West, that's different. If you pull your gun on somebody, then the other guy's got a right to shoot you back.
Yeah, but because he's a hothead.
He's a B-level player against Michael Jordan. There's no way that he's going to beat him.
Exactly. He knows that. And when he kills him, he falls backwards into the mud. And it's just the most gruesome, realistic. There was a stark realism to it. And Wilson's glee in shooting him dead. There was something in that moment that just ups the stakes. It makes you more afraid for the characters than if the music had swelled. If he had clutched his chest and had a big dramatic death and a woman screamed in the back.
He didn't have the constipated death we've talked about
a lot. No, even them having...
Films noir did that so much back in the day. Somebody would get shot and they do that kind of look on their face and fall out of the frame. But yeah, this is way more real.
Yeah, and even them having a funeral. Even that like stuck out for me that they made a big deal about his funeral because so often characters die in movies and then that's more or less the end of it, right? No, this is how it works in the real world. His family has to grieve for him. We have to find a new home for his dog, which of course broke my heart.
Yeah, that was a great scene.
Oh my God. That was just too much.
The irony is the Rikers would have won if they had not burned down the house of other people who were leaving after that funeral. They were out of there. Yeah. And then when everyone sees that, I thought, that's the last straw.
Yeah, it's
and
like
funny
that
thing
insult
is,
to injury.
The house was empty now, and the people that owned it weren't even there anymore. And they thought, well, let's go rebuild that place. You're going to help us out? Yeah, all right, let's work as a team.
Yeah, I kind of like that detail.
And the other thing, too, with Riker is that they would have gotten away with it if it weren't for that meddling Shane.
or that meddling kid.
Yeah, the kid who, if you notice, Joey is present for every important moment in this movie.
Yeah, he's kind of the perspective of the film. A lot of the
scenes
take place, from his perspective. And he's definitely the heart of the film. When we first see him, I think he's the first person you see in the film. Yep. He's aiming at the buck. And
you see Shane come in.
Yeah, and I see him. He kind of has that look of wide-eyed wonder. And it just reeks of amateur child acting, too. He just seems so wooden and silly. And I think I said to you, like, oh, no, I have a bad feeling about this because I'm not particularly forgiving of crummy child actors. But then I said to you later, he reminded me of Russell in
Harold Russell.
Yeah, Harold Russell in
The Best Years of Our Lives.
The Best Years of Our Lives, thank you. The actor who had lost his own arms for real in the war and then played the veteran who had lost his arms. And he wasn't a very good actor, but his heart made that film. There was just something so likable about him that it didn't matter and you loved him anyway. And that's how I ultimately felt about Joey, the character. He just wins you over so completely. There's something where he really captures that childlike enthusiasm and hero worship, and I think every one of us when we were a kid felt that and like loved somebody as much as he loves Shane and idolizes somebody as much as he idolizes Shane. Beautiful, like he really makes the film, his character.
Well, I guess I'm giving it away by saying this now, but here's a trivia question.
All right.
Who has the first and last line to dialogue in the film?
Well, Brandon DeWilde.
Yeah. He says something to his father about here comes somebody, and at the end it's the very famous line,
come back,
Shane! Come back, back. One thing I love about that scene, Shane has had a romantic feeling with Marion, but they've never acted on it. She's touched him twice. She cleans his head after Joe and Shane get in that fist fight with everybody. And then she shakes his hand when he leaves. That's the only time they ever
and
touch
they
each
dance.
Other.
They dance.
Oh, I forgot about the dancing. Yeah. Right, which is actually more intimate than those other two things.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's nothing that ever happens in the movie. The movie doesn't even imply that they snuck off at any point.
No.
And yet it's clear that Shane is interested in her and she's interested in him.
Yeah.
And at the end, when famous Shane come back line happens before it, though, the one that always gets to me is, and mother wants you. So the echo, and of course the kid doesn't mean to rub that thumb in even harder, but that's kind of what he's doing is, mother wants you, and the kid doesn't know what that can mean, but it means what we think it can
mean. They never make good on that promise that is made the first time Marion and Shane meet. You can tell right away that he can't take his eyes off of her, yet the viewer always knows what Shane is missing in his life. And what,
He wants this.
He wants to
and
be...
And in some ways, Joe wants to be the bad gunfighter.
Yeah, that's true.
Because he's ready to go off and die at the Rikers place.
And he knows he's going to die. He says, Shane can take care of you. He says, Shane can take my place.
And that was the first time in the film when I really got a little glassy-eyed. Because that really got to me. I've seen the movie many times. I guess I'd forgotten that that happened. Where he's essentially saying, I know I'm not going to come back from this, but it's probably better anyway. Because this guy's better for you than I am, and... You get the feeling that if Marion and Joe were ever physically in love, that that may have passed, just as happens to people in modern era and old era and any era, but that they would have maybe been better friends, that there's not a lot of passion.
I don't know. I disagree with
Well,
you
when Joe
that.
Watches the two of them dance,
yeah,
he can see it even then. He realizes that, okay, I love this woman. I think she loves me back, but this is not...
There's a spark of jealousy, but there's a spark of recognition as well that he could be replaced. But disagree with that assumption that maybe their marriage has gone stale. He loves her so much. When she comes out and she's wearing that dress and he says to Shane, that's the woman you wait for. And meanwhile, they've been married for 10 years and he's still saying that. I don't get that sense at all that he's bored with her or she's bored with him. I think they love each other a great deal and they're a great couple and they belong together, absolutely. The happy ending is those two staying together with Joey. But without that implication of an attraction between Shane and Marion, and even Shane and Joey. Shane loves Joey back. This last scene where Joey's calling after him has been lampooned to death, right? Like, people make fun of it. And I always knew about that last scene because of the lampoon. So I was prepared for this kind of silly, over-the-top scene of him calling after him. But on the contrary, by the time we got there and Joey is calling after him, my heart breaks. His lamenting cries, trying to get Shane to turn around and come back. And it's not for Joey's sake that you're upset. It's for Shane's sake of everything he's missing out on because he has such a real connection with this family.
And maybe this has happened to him before. Again, we never find out what his backstory is. So this is a perpetual thing for him. Can people really change?
Yeah. He says to Joey, once you've killed somebody,
it's a brand that sticks.
It's a brand that sticks, that's right. I think I asked you at the top of the film because it was the title sequence, the letters look like branding irons. And at first I was like, are those flowers? Like, I couldn't really make out what it was, and they must have been branding irons, if that's the theme. Yeah, right?
Also playing into the notion that the villains are
cattlemen,
and of course they'd be branding their cows.
Yeah, exactly. And he's implying that there's certain things that just can't be undone. He knows that he can't just turn around and then go back to being a farmhand. He can't go to the general store after that and mingle and socialize with the rest of the homesteaders now that he's committed a triple murder.
Although the point that he tells Joey, go tell your mother that there's no more guns in the valley, something's going to fill that void. Somebody's going to fill the Riker's void, or maybe one of the homesteaders will say, hey, maybe I should take
Riker's
control.
Riker's conflict, and this is another great thing about this film, in a way he's justified, you know, for all those years.
Not a pure villain.
No, for all those years he had his cattle on that land until the government just decided to give that land away, and he lost, maybe not his livelihood, he seems to still be doing all right, but he says, oh, I just got this meat contract. I would have been a rich man, or I could be a rich man if it wasn't for these homesteaders.
Yeah, putting up the fences.
Yeah, and like, who do they think they are? They just show up because the government says they can. They don't have a marshal within 100 miles. Who is the government to him? These are just people that showed up and staked.
And the irony of Rufus Riker, Morgan's the other brother, but Rufus is the one that does most of the talking. For a guy like this, for a murderer, a guy who hires a murderer, he's respectful of Starrett. He tries to negotiate with him more than once, and with Shane, he offers him a job. And when Shane goes to the bar at the end of the movie, it's, I ain't got no conflict with you. You can walk out of here and no hard feelings. And you get the feeling that if Shane had thought, okay, maybe that's the right thing, Wilson wasn't going to be told by Riker, yeah, shoot him in the back. He would have been able to leave, and that would have been the end of it.
Yeah.
He's also bullied Starrett into going to that bar to get what's coming to him and to get shot down, but not before trying to work other things out. But the other irony is that he does burn down that place when he doesn't need to.
I know.
And he hires the guy that kills Stonewall Torrey, who really hasn't done anything wrong to deserve that.
Yeah.
So he's got this very strange bullying tactic with some people, and now with others.
Yeah, maybe not a very effective bully.
Well, the other guy in the movie who looks like he's going to be a villain early on is the one who starts some of the trouble, Ben Johnson, who we're going to see in a few AFI movies in our future.
Played Chris.
Plays Chris Calloway, And he's got the line in the early on scenes where Shane's changing those blue clothes. There's another thing, by the way. The poster in this film and so many of the pieces of artwork are Shane in that beigey yellow buckskin outfit, which is also a little bit effeminate with all the fringes and whatnot.
It's also very Native American. If everything's made of leather, even the lace that holds the shirt together is a leather lace. It kind of seems very of the land.
But he doesn't wear that outfit much in the movie.
No.
He wears this blue and gray.
Yeah, it's working.
He actually is dressed a lot like Joey as far as colors go, actually.
Yeah, that's true.
Joey's got a blue shirt on through most of the movie and grayish kind of pants. Grayish, dark. Anyway, so back to Calloway, though. The exchange in the bar very early on in the film, Shane says, you speaking to me? I was the ML standing there. And what do we know at those lines in a different form? Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Makes you wonder if maybe Paul Schrader or even De Niro himself, because De Niro improvised that, was a Shane fan.
Had to be. It seems pulled directly from Shane. Yeah. There's a couple of lines in a row, just everything, the speed and the pacing, the cadence, said precisely the same way by Travis.
The nice thing about that is that the one character in the film who looks like a villain, who turns out to not be a villain, Calloway has a nice change of heart and kind of does the right thing in the end.
Yeah. Again, all these characters have so much depth. Even Wilson, he's a psychopath. He's not like a mustache-twisting villain. He really plays it like a guy who enjoys murder in the realistic manner that you would play someone like that.
Except maybe he would argue, and maybe this was Palance's inspiration. People who play villains in movies always say that they have to see the humanity of that villain, even if it's Hannibal Lecter or Darth Vader or one of those kinds of people, to know how they're going to play it to get that character. I bet with Palance it was a matter of, I'm good at this, but I've also been hired to do this. I might as well enjoy what I do for a living.
And he sure does. Yeah. But that's what adds to how sinister he is.
Let's get back to the Starrets and Shane, though. Now, one thing that I think is very true is that if you're not blonde in this movie, you're no good. Because arguably Van Heflin is blonde, and certainly Marion and Joey are very blonde, as is Shane. Shane has a ring on his wedding finger.
Yeah, that's
but it's not a typical wedding ring. No. It's an elaborate thing. Again, playing into the notion of his backstory. Is it a wedding ring, and maybe something terrible happened to his family?
Yeah, why would he wear that ring on his ring finger? Mm-hmm. Good question.
And maybe that's part of what Marion sees in him, because it's the old story you hear about all the time. If a man was a wedding ring, he becomes more attractive, and maybe it's the same deal, too. She thinks, oh, at some point, somebody loved this drifter. And maybe that's part of Marion's attraction, too, is that when he shows Joey how to shoot, she doesn't witness the part where he's telling Joey, look, I'm going to show you how to do this and do this the right way. But he's not telling Joey, yeah, let's shoot guns. Yeah. It's more a matter of, you're going to do this properly.
Yeah, exactly.
But then she has the problem with him by saying, my son's not going to do this stuff. And she's as close to angry in the movie at anybody as she ever gets was with Shane in that scene. And they have a respectful conversation. But you get the feeling that if there was ever going to be a turn where she didn't respect him anymore, that would have been it.
It would have been over violence.
Yep. But earlier in the film, she has the line where she says to Joey, don't get to liking Shane too much. Yeah. Why not? Because I don't want you to. That might as well be Marion saying that to herself.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then when she and Joe have their night together, where they clearly are going into their room to have some romantic time, I hate to be disrespectful to her husband, but she's probably thinking of Shane in that moment.
Like, the last thing she did was tend to Shane's wound, and then he disappears after, well, she goes in to talk to her son, talks about how much he loves Shane. She's like, oh, I like him too. She comes out, Shane's gone, next best thing, where are you?
But then again, there's more sexual tension in this movie between the men than there's been in the man-woman relationships in most of our previous AFIs.
I know.
Some of the scenes with Shane and Joe, I'm obviously being wise here.
There's a serious bromance. When they're taking down that tree stump, and the music's swelling, and they're pushing with all their might, and their shirts are off.
Why not use the horses? Just saddle them up and pull it out of there. Well, as a man's got to put his muscles and his sweat into it himself. Because that's sexy.
But they're definitely very fond of one another.
And then even the relationship that Shane has with Jack Wilson, as little as there is of it. You're my rival, and I know that we're going to have a conflict, and one of us is going to kill the other one. But there's something that's sort of oddly erotic, might not be the right word for it, but I'll use it anyway. Strangely erotic about that.
Yeah, they're drawn to one another. There's a respect for what they do. I mean, they're both gunfighters. And he knows who Wilson is the second he hears his name.
He's a low-down Yankee liar. This movie has the quote, we've already said it, we're going to get to it at the end with where it ranks on the quotes list about Shane come back. But my two favorite quotes in the whole movie are that one.
Oh, it's
I've said that to myself for reasons. I don't even know why I say that sometimes. So I'll just be randomly walking around here at home by myself and just say that low-down Yankee liar.
Of course, it's a great callback to the last thing Stonewall Torrey said before Wilson shot him down.
Yeah.
And so good.
Wilson smiles in both cases. And it's not like, he doesn't look like he's all that offended. He's just going to go ahead and use that as a motivation. Well, I guess I can shoot you then. The other line I like so much is the one where Ernie Wright says, don't go poking holes in the air with your finger.
Yeah, implying he doesn't want to go to the town meeting
for them
just to watch people
talk and nothing comes
get
of it.
Angry and point their finger in the air.
Modern movies certainly do this a lot of the time too, but sometimes the old movies have a great way of summarizing the way somebody's thinking, especially some of these not so literate people, the way they would come up with a line of dialogue that way. The Coen brothers do that so well, some of their moron characters that speak the way they do, and it's very memorable. And it's ironic how often the quotes that I like so much, and maybe you do too, don't make the top 100 quotes list. Because I like Shane come back, but I think those two quotes are better. And speaking of likes, I should have said this off the top. This is a movie that's got a very strange relationship with the AFI and then with modern audiences and critics. The Rotten Tomatoes critics gave it 97%, but only 81% of audiences.
I saw that. That's crazy.
Nearly 20% fewer. And the IMDb doesn't even give it an 80%. They rank it out of 10. It's 7.9 or something out of 10.
Yeah, I don't understand.
And so many movies that are in their top 250, the IMDb's top 250, are very debatably even okay movies. And here's one that didn't even get an 8.
I know, it's surprising that one of the criticisms I saw about it was that it's too intentionally important. It insists upon itself.
To quote Peter about The Godfather, Peter from Family Guy.
Yeah. I strongly disagree with that. And I'm surprised that watching the film, I didn't really see that much about it that I felt would have been alienating to anybody who would have had the idea to even sit down and watch a film like this in the first place. Why they wouldn't like what they saw. Maybe they're expecting a traditional Western. I don't know. I'm surprised.
Well, what surprises me, though, is just how all over the place that is.
Yeah.
Nearly 100% of people, then 8 out of 10. Yeah. And then less than 8 out of 10. And then the AFI gives it a pretty good ranking the first time, and then 45.
Yeah.
Jumps up nearly 30 places.
Yeah.
And yet there are some people in the business who are well-revered. We've mentioned this guy a lot lately, and so has the media. Woody Allen. And he once said it was one of the very best movies ever made, and he also said it held up whether it was thought of as a Western or not.
Yeah.
Sam Peckinpah, who did The Wild Bunch, mm-hmm. we're going to cover that quite a ways from now, towards the end of this year. But he revered it as well. I heard that in the commentary. I was listening to that. By the way, one more callback to the glassy-eyed thing we talked about. When I finished listening to the commentary downstairs, it was the scene where Joe and Marion talk about how he's going to go basically off to die, and he knows that she's better off with Shane anyway. And even hearing the commentary part, because the George Stevens Jr., the director's son, and Ivan Moffat, they weren't talking at that point. I guess that's why. Because a commentary shouldn't make me feel emotional.
But yeah.
This movie never moved me like that before. Oh, I didn't finish my point about why I got so emotional when the movie was over. Recently, I've been listening to Kevin Smith, the very well-known director of the Clerks movies, talk about The Dark Knight Rises. And I've also read a little bit about it. I've watched scenes from the movie on YouTube. And Smith gets really choked up at the end when Batman tells Commissioner Gordon that he's Bruce Wayne the way he does. He doesn't actually say it. He says, anyone can be a hero. Even if somebody does something as reassuring as putting a coat around a little boy's shoulders, to let him know the world hadn't ended. And when Smith is on the podcast talking with his friend Scott Mosher about that, he can barely get through it. He gets emotional. And that really got to me, I guess, when I heard it lately. So when we watch the movie, I'm thinking, Shane is kind of like an old Batman because he's willing to go out there for a cause that isn't really his cause and die for people. And it really got to me. I think that's why I was so emotional.
I've never actually caught you crying. Like, you've told me that you cried at movies before. Or get glassy-eyed, as you like to call it. But this is the first time I ever caught you in the act. It was crazy. Maybe it was you tried to get away from me afterwards.
Maybe it was a few of the drinks I had as well.
You had a few too many whiskeys. You should have thrown a few of those on someone's shirt.
Trivia question.
All right.
How many drinks does Shane buy in the scene where he throws a drink or drinks onto Chris Calloway before they get in their big fist fight?
Two, because he throws one on his shirt, and you think he's going to drink the other one. Instead, he throws it in his face.
Yep.
It's amazing.
And then punches him right in the face.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's one thing that's funny about the Calloway bullying early on in the film. Calloway mocks him for his clothes. He mocks him for buying the pop. Never once for his height. Alan Ladd was shorter than me.
Yeah, he's a really petite man.
He's 5'6".
Yeah.
And yet he played a lot of film noir characters. That's what he was mostly known for. And then this very famous Western tough guy. And of course, they de-emphasized his lack of height. Some movies would have played that up maybe, but George Stevens didn't really do that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that Alan Ladd was grateful that he didn't want to play up the fact that because Ben Johnson was 6'3".
Oh my God.
He was probably 50 or more pounds heavier than him,
He must have had Ladd on a few apple boxes in that scene.
They did with the starrets. Because he's about the same height as Gene Arthur.
Oh, wow.
But Van Heflin's a lot taller than him.
Mm-hmm.
And Heflin does tower over Gene Arthur, but he never really towers over Shane.
Hmm.
The way that they shoot that, he and Alan Ladd are kind of the same height. That's an old story, though. Tom Cruise and many other people who are shorter, you hear the stories about how things are shot with either apple boxes or just the way they frame them. So let's get into the credits now, as we always do. Alan Ladd, his first appearance since his tiny little role at the end of Citizen Kane, 18 AFI movies ago. He also played Gatsby in the 1949 version of The Great Gatsby. And he did a lot of the B-flicks and film noir I talked about. And the cast, by the way, was supposed to have been Montgomery Clift playing Shane, William Holden playing Joe Starr. And I like those actors, both of them, better than Ladd and Heflin. But in a strange way, this movie is revered the way it is, and yet nobody is really all that famous in movie star standards. Jack Palance is the most famous person to have come out of that film.
Yeah.
Jean Arthur, this is her first AFI-er since Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 23 AFI movies ago. She starred in the silent pictures and then pretty much had retired about 5 years before this, but she came back as a favorite of George Stevens. They'd made a few films together, and this was her last movie. She went on to do other things, but no more films.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in her early 50s when they shot it, so now she's older. Now we've got the thing. We had it with Gene Kelly and his two musicals, where he's twice as old as his two co-stars.
Yeah.
Now, this isn't twice as old, but Jean Arthur is...
She had like a decade on both of them, didn't
she?
Yeah. And when I first saw her, I thought maybe they put makeup on her to make it look as though she was older than she was.
No, they age her down.
Yeah, they age her down. But I thought maybe it was, oh, well, the land, that's the life. It's hard on you. And
I can buy that.
She does kind of look her age. She's got the wig to young her up, and she's still like quite slim for her age. So that probably ages her down a little too, but you can see it on her face.
Yeah. The man who played her husband is Van Heflin. He won a supporting actor Oscar for Johnny Eager in the 40s. And he was also in the original 310 to Yuma, another Western. And his last movie was Airport, where he was the sweaty bomber. Good old Jack Palance, his only AFI film also. I think he's pretty well known. He was in Batman and City Slickers, where he won his Oscar, and he played a great thug in the 50s and 60s. His first film was Panic in the Streets.
And he does some killer one-arm push-ups, as we all saw at the Oscars.
Yep.
1 year. When was that? Do you remember? Do you know?
That was when he won the Oscar for City Slickers. So it would have been in 92 for the 91 movies.
He won the Oscar for that?
Yeah, Best Supporting Actor.
I only remember the one-arm push-ups.
Apparently he didn't know what else to do, so that's why he just wants to show off that as old as he was, he could still do push-ups.
Well, color me impressed.
Brandon DeWilde. The only other thing he did really of note was HUD, which was in the 60s, 1963, with Paul Newman. And he was very good in that, too. And he did a lot of guest spots on TV, but then he died at 30 in a car wreck.
Oh, what a shame.
Mm-hmm. Ben Johnson, we talked about him, the mouthy thug turned repentant friend. Chris Calloway, this is his first of three AFIers. He's going to be in The Wild Bunch. We've talked about that already. And The Last Picture Show, where he won a supporting actor Oscar. A lot of these guys did that in other films. Wild Bunch, incidentally, is 31 AFI movies from now. That's a big gap. One of the bigger ones we are ever going to have for an actor to have between his movies. Elisha Cook Jr., his second AFIer after being in The Maltese Falcon. He was also in The Big Sleep, The Killing, and Rosemary's Baby. We're going to watch The Killing. I got that as a Christmas present.
One of the few sometime Kubrick movies soon. I've never seen.
Mm-hmm. We get to Kubrick later this year. The Killing is not one of his films, but finally see Spartacus and then Strangelove and so on. And very briefly, Emil Meyer plays Rufus Riker, and Paul McVeigh is Sam Grafton. Our director, George Stevens, is third of four AFIers. You did not like his first two at all. I was not the biggest fan myself, but he finally hit a home run here.
He redeemed himself here.
And this is his best film. Giant still ahead for us. Super duper melodrama. The Dallas of movies. But we'll see what we think of that one in a little while. This man had been to war, as had Frank Capra when he came back and did Wonderful Life. And he didn't want a glorification of violence in this film, but he wanted to see a movie that showed what gunfights and bullets will do to people.
Yeah, they actually invented techniques. For instance, I think this is the
cables
first,
that pull people
the cables
back.
That pull people backwards. And then the audio that they used to express gunshots was different. It was sharper. It was louder.
A lot louder, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is Warren Beatty did. And well, maybe it wasn't just Warren Beatty, but Warren Beatty and Arthur Penn for Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, yeah.
And then modern movies, too. I mean, things like the Terminator movies and you name it, actually, with the gigantic sound of gunfire. I don't know much about guns, but I don't think they're that loud.
Well, you talk about influence. That was an influence. That was something that, from there on in, filmmakers chose whether to follow Shane's example or the old way of doing things. But eventually, just about every film is going to have gunshot sounds just like Shane had.
Mm-hmm. The screenplay of this movie was written by A.B. Guthrie, with additional dialogue by Jack Scherer. They based on Jack Schaefer's 1949 novel. Now, they're a pretty fast turnaround. We talked about Gone with the Wind and Grapes of Wrath. They were turned around very quickly and turned into movies. This movie actually was shot, I think it was before High Noon, but it was released quite a bit after because Stevens was one of those guys that got an editing room forever.
Yeah.
And that's why it took so long to release it. I mentioned in the description early on that it was a big budget film. It wasn't supposed to be as big as it was.
Yeah, he went over budget.
Mm-hmm. But then they were rewarded with a lot of box office, especially for 1953. And I mentioned Guthrie, who wrote it. He was a novelist, actually, of Westerns, and he only wrote a handful of screenplays. The producers were the director, Stevens, and Ivan Moffat. I mentioned him already, an associate producer. And he also wrote Giant, which we'll cover eventually, and he was an associate producer on A Place in the Sun. All right, the tech talk stuff. Technicolor film, and this is still in 4x3. Our very first bona fide widescreen color movie we're going to get is Rebel Without a Cause, three movies from now. But this one actually was interesting. You may have read this in your research.
Yeah.
Paramount cropped it. So it was shot 4x3, but they showed the movies in theaters in a 1.66:1 ratio. Then, of course, 1.85:1, or the CinemaScope widescreen type look is what became more standard.
It was the first film
first
to
time
be,
they did that,
Yeah, and they had to re-outfit Radio City Music Hall to accommodate the new aspect ratio, but they ultimately released a film in 4x3 because movie theaters, their screens just wouldn't fit a widescreen film, period.
I think the DVD, and I've not watched this movie in quite a while on the DVD. We watched the Blu-ray. Hey, there's another thing. Great looking movie yet again. We said it about Sing in the Rain. We said it about All About Eve and some other recent Blu-ray.
Yeah, great transfer. And we haven't mentioned this yet, how beautiful this movie is. It's set on the backdrop is the, how do you say it, the mountains?
The Grand Tetons.
Oh my God.
And the Rocky Mountains. Northwestern Wyoming.
Oh my God. Every vista is so beautiful. These homes, these little log cabins with the rivers. You can see the appeal. It's just really beautiful.
If you have to be in the middle of nowhere, I don't mean for the filmmaking, but if this was a real story, if you have to be in the middle of nowhere, this is the middle of nowhere to be. It's pretty beautiful. And they have water and they have there is grass. It's not just a desolate wasteland. For sure. Well, yeah, the man who shot the movie, cinematographer, Loyal Griggs, only his fourth film. He also did The Ten Commandments and George Stevens, The Greatest Story Ever Told.
Mm-hmm.
But he and Stevens decided to use long lenses to enhance the tall peaks of the mountains in the background. Mm-hmm. So they're always in sharp focus and not distant as they would be.
Yeah.
And I would say half the shots in this movie could be on a postcard.
Oh,
particularly
so gorgeous.
The mountains are in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thing we saw in this movie we don't see a lot of in the movies we've covered so far is Day for Night.
Yeah, there's a lot. It's pretty extensive. Yeah,
the long sequence where Shane rides into town. It's pretty clear the day for night. I mean, when you see clouds, and it's darkish gray kind of looking because of the day for night technique. But the sky was clearly just piercing blue.
Yeah.
And then Shane has the shadow that he wouldn't really have.
I'm grateful that day for night has gone the way of the dodo. They don't really shoot that way anymore.
No, with the way the cameras open up the shutter, I guess it is, and
yeah, you can just light a night scene instead. Yeah,
and just modern film stocks with things like Heat, the way that Michael Mann shot that, and then Collateral, and then he and other people with digital filmmaking, and how that requires so much less light. Now, here's something I don't think you're going to like as much as the look of the film, the screenplay, the acting, and the various other technical credits: the music.
Yeah, there's a little overkill.
Victor Young's score. Yeah, and also repetitive.
Yeah, and scenes that are blanketed with it that don't necessarily need it, where it's just like, all right, we get it. Just let the scene play. We don't need a soundtrack for
which
this.
We've said on many other AFI films. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's too much music. There's
there are some great key scenes, though, where they drop the music altogether.
Yeah.
The barroom brawl, it's starkly quiet for the whole thing. Another kind of violent scene that felt strangely, acutely realistic until he's joined by his friend Joe when the music swells and
they fight together. Kicking the butts of these dirty old men. But yeah, Young wrote a lot of music scores, and I mean a lot. He also was involved in The Greatest Show on Earth, The Quiet Man, and Around the World in 80 Days, except for The Quiet Man. That's not a really good bunch of films there. Although those two, Greatest Show and Around the World, did win the Oscars, and they didn't deserve to. The editors were William Hornbeck, who edited four AFI films, and Tom McAdoo. I believe Hornbeck was involved with Stevens and Frank Capra.
So they were the saints that spent 2 years
putting up with Stevens, probably tweaking things constantly.
Which is like annoying enough now with digital. I can only imagine when every time they want to make a change, it's a film strip. Mm-hmm. Go back and untape it and re-physically cut it.
Yeah. And the costumes, Edith Head, once again. Next time we're going to talk about her is Rear Window in a few weeks. She's been involved in a lot of the films. We're going to cover her quite a bit more with the Hitchcock films.
Like we mentioned last time, we've brought her up. She is the character homaged in The Incredibles.
Mm-hmm. No capes.
No capes.
And I don't know if it was her choice to outfit Shane the way that she does, but that is definitely a very iconic outfit. And such an unusual looking outfit. Just like the outfit Eastwood wears in the spaghetti westerns.
The poncho.
And the cigarillos and the pants and everything that he wears, the hat and everything. And John Wayne's outfits, and they were kind of the same, but a little bit different. He certainly is iconic. But this one, this one's going to last. Because it's so not cool in a way. He looks kind of kind of silly.
Maybe it was cool back in the 19th century, but it also serves as a really good contrast to the work clothes that he wears later. Mm-hmm. Like, he is trying to be somebody he's not, but he really is that guy in the buckskin. Mm-hmm. The work clothes were his costume, but it's a stark difference between the two, which is probably why the outfit had to be kind of as out there as it is.
And here's a trivia question on that note. How much does Shane's new working man's outfit cost him?
$2?
And?
20 cents?
Yep. No, 25 cents.
Oh, I was very close.
All right, the very extensive influence. We covered some of this, so we'll gloss over a few of them. We mentioned the Taxi Driver one, and the one that we talked about already where Stonewall dies in the mud is probably, I don't know if it necessarily is, but it seems like it might have been homaged by Robert Altman in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Another movie we'll put on our list that we've got to watch one time.
Okay.
I won't say who it is, but a character dies in somewhat of a similar kind of way, in a similar kind of sad, pathetic death. There's a Kevin Spacey, Sam Jackson conversation in The Negotiator all about this movie, about is Shane dead at the end? Whoever, I think it's Spacey, insists that he is, and Jackson says that he's not. And he's not clearly dead, if he is at all. Mm-hmm. Another trivia question. Which of Shane's arms is hanging stiffly at his side as he rides away?
His left one?
Right, because that's where he took the shot from the other Riker brother who was up top.
Yeah, yeah.
And because Joey's present, Shane, look out!
Yeah.
And he does get shot, but at least he doesn't get killed. But as he's riding away, something's wrong with him. And he is bleeding, for one thing. And, you know, get help for you, Leave. It's made to patch you up. Maybe he knows it's a mortal wound, though.
You and I had this argument ourselves after the movie. It never even dawned on me that he would die from that wound. I guess that there's a school of thought that he did, that he's leaving to die.
In The Negotiator, I think it is Spacey that insists that he's hunched over his horse. And he's not hunched over his horse at all. Although the second to last shot is him riding through the cemetery, which is probably meant to be metaphorical, obviously. A very direct remake was made with, we mentioned before, Clint Eastwood, Pale Rider. And even more Christian symbology, is that the right word here? And it is clearly a Shane ripoff. I don't know if they even acknowledge it. Patrick Swayze made a futuristic thriller called Steel Dawn. And there was a TV series in the 60s with David Carradine playing the lead character.
I think when you're talking about influence, and I can't really say this with confidence, and it's probably something that was happening in international films as well, but the realism of the violence that we keep bringing up over and over again, maybe that's what makes this movie feel modern. And maybe it contributed to changing the way Hollywood portrayed violence.
It could be. They still weren't really showing blood, but that would have been the censor board anyway. You see a little bit of blood on Shane's hand when he's talking to Joey at the very end of the film, and you see a little bit on Calloway's face after he gets punched in the face mm-hmm. by Shane. Of course, The Wild Bunch, we talked about a few times already. That movie was very famous. It's a good movie to begin with, but its influence is mm-hmm. that people are blown to bits in that film.
Yeah, and it's hard to look at. Mm-hmm. After Shane knocks Joe unconscious, as he starts to come to, he says to Marion, now as soon as he's ready, you have to get him up and walk him around. It's the consequences of violence that are shown as well. Mm-hmm. He has a massive concussion now. This isn't just a convenient knocking him out. He's really hurt, just like they were really hurt after the barroom brawl. They weren't out drinking whiskeys afterwards. They were having their wounds tended to, which could also be part of why his left arm is slumping at the end of the film. He got shot. It's going to take him a while to heal because that's the consequence of violence.
True, yeah. A lot of my favorite action films will have regular human characters, not the Terminator, but regular human characters go through absolute hell and come out of it, and they're cracking wise. They should be badly hurt. Yeah.
The number of times people in movies and TV shows get knocked unconscious, which is brain damage, like mm-hmm. the amount of damage you have to sustain before you lose consciousness, is a lot. And the number of times people get knocked unconscious and it takes them like 30 seconds to come to, they shake it off and then they're fine. Yeah. But in reality, I had a concussion not too long ago. I didn't even get knocked unconscious and it was a month-long recovery.
Yeah, a lot of times these hockey players and football players and other sports too, when they go through a concussion, they may not be actually unconscious, but sometimes their career is over.
Yeah, that's right. It's like a massive injury that they sustain and then they treat it so lightly.
Shane and Sidney Crosby. A lot of things in common. Or maybe not. Okay, the awards and other AFI lists. The Oscar for Loyal Griggs' cinematography was the only one that it won. It was nominated for 5 others, including picture, director, the 2 supporting actors. Oh, I didn't say that already. Jack Palance and Brandon DeWilda. What a difference that is. Palance as Wilson barely talks, mm-hmm. and he's, of course, this incredible bad guy. And then Brandon DeWilda, the picture of innocence, and a fairly rare in the history of the Oscars nomination for a very young kid as well. Mm. Very much on the opposite end of the scale, those two getting nominated for that. And, of course, it was almost 40 years later before Palance would get nominated again mm-hmm. when he won for City Slickers. And then the screenplay by Guthrie was nominated as well. The National Film Registry honored the film in 1993, so it took him 4 years, but at least they got it in there. It was 53rd on the top 100. Cheers, most inspiring. Shane, come back! Was 47th on the top 100 quotes list. I wish I could get as high as he can, but I'm too old for that. Shane was the 16th best hero on the Heroes and Villains list. And the movie was 3rd in the Western category on the top 100 genres list. We talked about this last week.
Yeah.
Searchers was number 1, High Noon number 2, Shane number 3. So parting thoughts on Shane.
Beautiful film. Really wise and deep, but also entertaining and a real piece of iconic American art. I would recommend this to anybody, whether they liked classic films, whether they liked Westerns. I think this is a movie anybody can enjoy, even though IMDb may disagree with me.
Right. But your friend was correct then. You should have watched it a long time ago.
And I'm
glad you saw it now. It's one of those ones that I had not even heard of when the first list came out.
Oh, really?
And I saw it and liked it, and I liked it more each time. I think I've literally liked the movie more each time until it gets to the point where it nearly makes me weep.
I caught him. It's true.
It's Wonderful Life didn't even do that when we saw it together. Maybe I was holding back.
I just need to get the whiskey in you first. That's
okay. All right, so up next on the Top Runner Project is the movie that won many of the Oscars that Shane did not. From Here to Eternity, with Burt Lancaster, Monty Clift, Frank Sinatra, Donna Reed, and many others. Directed by the guy we covered last week with High Noon, Fred Zinnemann.
Ah, that's right.
And sorry, Fred, if you ever listen to this podcast, I don't think we're even alive, but we will try to talk more about you than we did on High Noon. Yeah. We barely mentioned your name. So the coming attractions trivia 4, From Here to Eternity. The movie is set during World War II. What's the next AFI film to be set during World War II? And what's the last AFI, or chronologically, to take place during that war?
Well, I know the answer to the second part of that question.
Okay. Well, you can say it next week.
So for the answer to that, tune in next week to the Top 100 Project. In the meantime, if you want more trivia and lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, please go to our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And please let us know what you thought of Shane and all the other movies we've covered. If you'd like to reach us, you can email us, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
Just don't be a low-down Yankee.
And cut.